Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
It's Real College Podcast. I'm Patrick Sharkey. Today's show is a little bit different than what we normally do. Whenever we have a producer graduate or quit or something along those lines, we like to go back and listen to some of their old stories to kind of pay an homage to all the work that they've put in to our show over the years. And today is no different. Our good friend and reporter and producer, Emily LaPaine, is graduating in May, but for this last semester, she is traveling to Chile. So she will not be reporting for us this semester, so we're taking the time today to play some of her old stories and share a couple memories about her as well. She's not dead. She's just moved on.
So I'm here with Emily LaPaine.
Hello.
She is one of our fine producers, and she will be sadly leaving us in roughly like 4 days.
I leave on Sunday.
To go to Chile. But you've been a producer here for
almost a year
now. How did you first get involved with the show?
Well, I've been DJing here I'm spending my last semester abroad, right? I've been DJing here since the beginning of sophomore year. So I've been, you know, around the station for like two-ish years. And then I am a journalism major, which many of us are. So
yeah, and then I recruited you.
Yeah.
I like to believe that I recruited you.
Yeah, you did. You did, technically.
I saw your potential.
Aw.
So then you came aboard, and you've been a producer ever since, right?
Yeah. It's been an interesting ride.
Certainly.
I don't know.
So typically what we do whenever one of our producers or one of our staff members leave, we do a special episode in their honor, and we basically air a couple of their stories that they're most proud of. We're going to do the same thing today. Emily, your first story is what?
So a long time ago, in my wee beginnings as a radio reporter, mm-hmm. that was in air quotes for anyone who can't see me right now, I did a story about the representation of geological events in cinema, in movies, specifically the San Andreas, which was a preposterous movie in general.
The Rock is the man.
It does have The Rock. It was an insane movie in general, mm-hmm. but what made it just ridiculous was the representation of a geological event, in that case, like an earthquake. So I went back, I did some research, I talked to a professor at one of the University of California schools who's an expert on the San Andreas, who actually was my mom's PhD advisor.
Oh.
And I also talked to my father, so you'll hear the dulcet tones of my dad, because my dad is a geologist, sedimentologist specifically. So that is what we're gonna hear first.
Okay, well let's listen to that now, and we'll be right back.
Whenever Hollywood releases a new natural disaster film, my father always groans. They always follow the same formula: cue natural disaster, insert a few pretty faces and a lot of scientific errors, and cover it up with an obscene amount of CGI destruction. But movies are often a form of escapism, so why does bad science in film matter? To find out, I asked my father, a petroleum geologist for the Alaska Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys.
If they get sensational information that is factually incorrect, and they initially believe it and maybe are scared by it, and then they subsequently find out that, that was bogus information, that was wrong, it was fictitious, the people didn't know what they were talking about, it tends to erode trust in the earth science community. So then subsequent information, they'll just sort of disregard it.
And while scientific accuracy isn't the only thing that makes a good movie, far-fetched representations of science can give the public inaccurate ideas of what's even possible within the realm of science, according to Justin Revenaugh, a seismologist and a professor for the University of Minnesota's Geology and Cinema course.
Our ability to control nature is usually very greatly overstated in movies. The core is a fantastic example of bad science all the way through, where people go to the Earth's core and restart it by blowing up some nuclear weapons. They would have no effect, and you can't get there anyhow. So it's often it's just based on a little premise that, you know, some screenwriter read something somewhere.
Our ability to predict earthquakes is also largely overstated. Take the movie San Andreas, for example. Paul Giamatti's character, a seismologist, discovers that the San Andreas Fault is shifting and will soon cause a major earthquake. But Revenaugh says there's no surefire way to predict when an earthquake will actually occur.
He's predicting earthquakes based on some sort of electromagnetic emission from a fault zone. There's a little something to that. That's been noticed before some earthquakes in the past, observed not to be present before some earthquakes, and it's observed to happen and no earthquake follows. But it's a phenomena that seismologists are looking into. And he takes that and completely predicts that, you know, all of California is going to rupture on the basis of it. And it's just completely implausible.
But the bad science doesn't stop there. The initial quake portrayed in San Andreas is a 9.1 magnitude event, and an even larger event, a 9.6 magnitude earthquake, occurs later in the movie. Dwayne The Rock Johnson told Jimmy Fallon that everything that occurs in San Andreas is entirely plausible, including the tsunami. But Thorne Lay, a seismologist and a professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at the University of California, Santa Cruz, says the events portrayed in San Andreas are entirely far-fetched.
In general, no, it's not possible. The movie had a lot of artistic license in conceiving the scenario that they came up with. The largest earthquake that we have recorded on the San Andreas Fault within kind of the documented history would be the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, which was about a magnitude 7.8 or 7.9 event.
The San Andreas Fault is also a strike slip fault, which means the Pacific Plate and the North American Plate are moving past each other side by side. But my father says there's no vertical motion like there is in a subduction-related earthquake.
Subduction is a process in which one plate on the Earth's surface slides underneath another plate. It's happening in along much of the margins of the present-day Pacific Ocean, so offshore from California, Oregon, Washington, and southwestern British Columbia. We have an oceanic plate sliding underneath the overriding North American plate. This occurs in what is referred to by geologists as a subduction zone, where that subducting plate slides smoothly underneath the overriding plate. You tend not to have large magnitude earthquakes. In areas where that subducting plate does not slide smoothly underneath the overriding plate, it tends to get locked up. Strain gets stored in the overlying plate until the rocks rupture. Where that is happening are where you tend to get large magnitude earthquakes. And in the process of the rocks rupturing, large tracts of the sea floor can become uplifted almost instantaneously. And in the process of that uplift, they displace enormous volumes of seawater. And that's what creates large tsunamis.
Amid all this bad science, Lay says that the majority of the students he teaches come into his introductory seismology class with no realistic idea of what can happen during an earthquake.
I have been teaching large groups of undergraduate students about earthquakes for many years, and I often find that what they know walking into the classroom for the first time actually comes from cinematic presentations of it. You can imagine that if you were in isolation from any other information source and all you had were movies like San Andreas to inform you about it, you wouldn't really be able to tell what's realistic, what's not.
And for anyone living in geologically active areas, this can be dangerous.
It's really important for people living in areas where there are significant geological hazards to have accurate information of what the risk is.
And so that's why I think it's very important for geoscientists to provide accurate information and provide the context so that the general public can make sense out of what the hazard is.
Movies are indeed a form of escapism, and for many, correct science may not matter. But for those living in areas with significant geological hazards, an accurate knowledge and understanding of what those hazards really are can be life-saving. For Real College Podcast, I'm Emily LePain.
So last year, November, we went to Cannonball, North Dakota for our Standing Rock show. It was three of us, me, Jaka, and then Emily, all piled into a University of Minnesota-stamped Ford Explorer. So it was an official trip. We had that representation. It was like a five-hour road trip to Cannonball from Minneapolis, I want to say. And it was just a very scenic, beautiful route. Throughout the whole road trip, we were surrounded by hills, cliffs, cornfields. It hadn't snowed yet in North Dakota or Minnesota, so everything was really green and just luscious. The only reason the imagery sticks with me so well is because Emily was talking about geology the whole time. She explained that her parents study it, they work with it, she had an interest in the topic. She grew up in Alaska, which is literally a geology gold mine. So that was all really interesting and fascinating. And I had never really, you know, thought of geology before, but it was cool being able to recognize it and what we were surrounded by. And even if I wasn't familiar with it, she was great at talking about it in a way that I could easily follow. And her passion was just so contagious that, I really caught on. I really enjoyed listening to it. And I think her contagious passion and her way to talk about things so other people follow is going to bring her far.
Okay, we're back now with Emily LePain for her a walk down memory lane as she gets ready to leave us and heads to Chile for her final semester in school. We just heard a story from her. I believe it was your very first story.
I think it was the very first story that I did.
Yeah, very first story that you did. Okay, so as you prepare to leave us, mm-hmm. Kind of think back of your time here mm-hmm. working for the show, and maybe you can tell us about some of the ways you saw yourself progress, whether it's different skills or personality-wise.
For sure. As a child, like a young person.
A child.
Like 9, 10, okay. 11. I was very outgoing and very didn't care about... I didn't really give a crap about... Can I say that?
Sure.
Can I say crap? I didn't really care about what people thought of me, and I was very outgoing, and I was not shy in any way. And then growing up, I definitely kind of... That was something that I had to struggle with, because growing up, going through high school, and then starting college, I became very introverted. I was not as outgoing as I used to be, and I got very shy. And I didn't really feel comfortable walking up to random people that I had never met and would never see again. So that was something that I definitely struggled with when I first started, not even like with the podcast, but just like with my journalism degree in general, because that's definitely something that we had to do for several classes. And in like certain situations, I still feel that, like if I'm covering something that's like very, like there's some sort of like cultural sensitivity, racial sensitivity that I feel like I have to have and like kind of, then I kind of get that again. Like, I feel like I had that at Standing Rock. I feel like I was very unsure of how to conduct myself. But overall, I feel like that's something that I've kind of grown out of, the feeling of, like, feeling unsure about approaching people. Like, will they reject me? Like, it's just kind of that, like, fear of rejection that I think I've gotten over in terms of, like, journalism in general and, like, doing interviews with people you don't really know. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. it's hard to kind of have that level of I wouldn't say comfort, but that level of like feeling generally at ease that I think that I've kind of grown into, and I've achieved that, which is good, I suppose.
So now we're going to listen to a second story of yours. Do you want to tell us about that at all?
It's about national parks. Mm. And a while ago, there were some proposals as to sell, there were some proposals that were put forth in different state governments, and I think there was also one kind of in the House of Representatives and in Congress that talked about selling off public lands, particularly national parks, and what that would do in terms of, like, access for people to hunt or access for oil drilling or anything like that, which was a big concern for a lot of people who opposed the bills. So I did a story on that, like what would really happen, I guess, if the national parks were sold off or if public lands were sold off and to private interests. So I think I kind of talked about that, and I talked to a guy who's kind of an expert on public lands. And it was a really interesting conversation. It was a very short interview because he was literally in D.C. for a meeting on the proposals. He gave a very good interview.
He did, yeah. I remember it being really insightful, and I learned a lot from it. And I guess we can listen to that now, unless you had anything else you wanted to add.
We can listen to that now.
Okay, let's do that, and then we'll be right back with Emily Lepine.
In 1936, President Franklin D. Roosevelt said, "There is nothing so American as our national parks. The fundamental idea behind the parks is that the country belongs to the people for the enrichment of the lives of all of us." Since then, the National Park Service has grown to almost 400 parks. From Denali National Park and Preserve in Alaska to the Selma to Montgomery National Historic Trail in Alabama, our national parks tell the stories of our immense history and cultural heritage in this country. Recently, the GOP has added public lands as an issue to their political platform. The newly approved platform expands the party's support for returning federally held lands to state ownership. However, not everyone supports this proposal. To learn more, I talked to Lan Tawney, the president and CEO of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, a nonprofit sportsman organization based in Montana that looks to preserve our outdoor heritage of hunting and fishing and prevent the development of untouched land in North America.
There could be nothing more unique in America than our public lands. That's what separates us from every other country. And so for those folks that want to sell our public lands, pay off the national debt, pay to the highest bidder, there couldn't be anything, more short-sighted than that and un-American.
Tawney says that keeping these lands in public hands is vitally important, not only for our hunting and fishing heritage, but for the economy these lands and parks generate.
Because of this great history that we have that is unique in anywhere else in the world. So our public lands, are owned by all Americans. And so when people talk about either transferring them to the States or selling them, that goes to a really small amount of people versus every single American who has a right to these public lands.
The call to return public lands to state ownership comes mostly from Republicans in Western states with large tracts of public lands who have long argued that the federal government is a poor land manager. But Tawney disagrees.
But the biggest problem there is that Congress has been starving the budget of these federal agencies for decades now. And so it's like, if you don't feed yourself, you will get sick. And that's what's happening to our federal lands right now. They're not being taken care of because Congress has systematically taken away the funding that is for them. So all these questions about management, you can just throw money at things and it gets fixed. But that's a major reason why there's frustration with management, is just because they've been systematically defunding the agency.
There have also been disagreements over rules limiting logging, mining, hunting, and hydraulic fracturing for oil and gas production on public land. While there are ways to do resource extractions, such as hydraulic fracturing, with little to no environmental consequences, there is no guarantee that all companies will take the time to understand the geology of the area or take the appropriate precautions in designing the processes necessary for safe resource extraction in order to ensure minimal chance of damaging the surrounding environment. Doing so also costs more money. So there are concerns that transferring publicly held lands to state ownership could allow for further privatization of these lands for profit, much to the detriment of the environment as well as those who frequent these lands for recreational use, such as campers, hikers, or hunters.
Mining, logging, resource extraction happens right now on our National Forest, the Bureau of Land Management land. So when people say that that's not happening, this couldn't be anything farther from the truth. What would happen if these lands were either sold to private interests or to given to the states is the states have to generate money from these. And so, that's a much different management style than what we have right now. And so hunters and anglers lose every single time when it's either transferred to the states or sold to private individuals. And And majority of that is for resource extraction, which, you know, I think as an organization, we totally support, but like in a responsible kind of conservation-wise use. If you don't have the mandate for multiple use that our federal managed lands do, then you don't do it for one purpose, right? And that's to make money. And again, like that means more timber harvest and maybe unsustainable timber harvest. It means more rape and pillage than it does sustainable use, I would say.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Emily LePain.
Hands down, my best memory with Emily would have to be Standing Rock. We went together to report on everything that was going on, along with Emily Allen as well. We were super nervous going into it because this was going to be a big deal. Radio K had never really sent people to cover anything, and it was going to air across the state. We spent the six-hour drive talking about how nervous we were, but also just sort of getting to know each other. The one thing I remember super distinctly was that Emily started talking to us about earthquakes and stuff like that. Her parents are both geologists, and I have never been interested in geology at all. It was just not my thing. But Emily had a way of telling a story about an earthquake or a potential earthquake that made it super interesting to me. I even went and researched it after the trip. And now I'm taking a geology course because of her. She just had this way of telling the story that made it super interesting, something that I never thought I could be interested in. And I think that that's something that she brought to the podcast. She had this sort of way of telling stories that made something that maybe wouldn't be interesting to the average person, and she made it super interesting. I know that I'm going to miss her a lot. She was sort of my partner in crime when it came to bugging Patrick whenever we could, and I just think that she brought a very unique voice to the podcast that will definitely be missed. Emily, have fun in Chile. Have fun being graduated, even if you do end up going back to school for geology. And that's super cool that you might do that because you clearly have an interest in it and you make it really interesting. But I know you're going to do awesome things, whatever it is that you do. And I know that you'll continue to tell great stories, whether that's in journalism or in geology. I wish you all the best and we'll miss you a lot here at the podcast.
Okay, welcome back, Real College Podcast. I'm here with Emily LePain, our fine producer who will be leaving us in like 4 days.
Yeah,
as she departs for,
it's really approaching,
a foreign country. So for our last, your last story that you're going to discuss, I believe is your piece on Standing Rock.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about how that opportunity came up and what that experience was like?
Yeah. So, I mean, I had seen a lot of stuff I'd seen a lot of stuff in the media about it, not necessarily the mainstream media, but a lot of kind of,
and a lot of social media too, like,
yeah,
just a lot of reports coming from the camp itself.
A lot of social media was on it. There was a lot of stuff on social media about it, and it was a big, it's a particularly big issue, obviously. I mean, cause we have the oil pipe, like we have so many pipelines and there have been so many, pipeline mishaps over the years. It wasn't a pipeline, but just oil mishaps in general. Like, you had BP in the Gulf of Mexico, and that was a disaster. And then you had the Exxon Valdez run aground in Prince William Sound in Alaska, which was also a disaster. And growing up in Alaska and visiting Valdez, you still see the effects on the environment and the ecosystem decades later. Like, I remember going to Valdez when I was a kid, and, like, you could, you know, like, the beaches weren't the same. They didn't look the same. They were all kind of sludgy, you know, like, and even after, like, the massive cleanup efforts that they had, like, you can still see. And so it's, like, it's entirely understandable why there's a big concern about the Dakota Access Pipeline, because it's going underneath the Missouri River, which is a huge water source, not only for the native tribes and the indigenous tribes in the area, but, you know, for everybody kind of south of that. Like, if something were to happen in the Missouri River, it would screw up the water supply for millions and millions of people. It's an environmental issue, but it's also an issue of Native liberation. And I think that that's the thing that I really picked up on and really opened my eyes while we were there. So I think
I think that's definitely, like, the most proud I've been of a episode and a show that we've done since I've been part of the show. I'm really glad that we were able to make that happen and that you took that initiative and was able to report so well on it. So let's listen to that now, and then we'll be back.
You know, it's to me, it's like government-supported terrorism.
That's Ann Dunn, an Ojibwe native from the Leech Lake Indian Reservation in Minnesota. If you flip back through the history books, this sort of conduct isn't necessarily new. It seems to be a common theme since Europeans first had contact with Native Americans in the late 15th century, after Christopher Columbus first sailed the ocean blue in 1492. But why has the Dakota Access Pipeline blown up into such a big issue? Dunn says it's because it's an invasion, and more importantly, it's to protect the water.
I came to support this effort against this invasion. I'm also here because, like many, many people, I'm concerned about the quality of our water in defending this good mother who has done so much for us, provides us with everything.
Dunn's mother used to say that this fight isn't just about us. It's about the wildlife. It's about the Green Nations.
All they want to do is help us. The Green Nations don't make war on people. They don't make war on monkeys. They just want to help us, and they provide shade, building material, that's obvious. And you know what? They provide beauty and magic and music.
But this fight isn't just about the environment or protesting a pipeline for the people at Standing Rock and the Sacred Stone or Oshedi Sakowin camps. This is also about making their voices heard. Russell Eaglebear from the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, one of the seven council fires of the Lakota people, is from the Standing Rock Reservation, and he says that consultation of federal agencies with Native and Indigenous peoples is very misrepresented.
For example, I'm the tribal historic preservation officer, and we handle two levels of consultation.
One level is government to government. So, for example, the federal agency is supposed to meet with tribal leaders to let them know what's going to happen with the Dakota Access Pipeline and to get their approval.
That didn't happen.
And on the second level, the federal agency is supposed to check that the proposed project would not disturb any cultural or sacred sites.
They didn't do that because all of it's done on private land. The only connection we had is on the federal land. When they're going to cross federal land, they have to consult with us. Well, if they call my office, for example, and they don't get through to me, they call it consultation. And that's not right. You know, it's not right.
But both Eaglebear and Dunn echoed a similar sentiment. Eventually, this pipeline will fail, and that's what they're truly afraid of.
It's all here, and we need to take care of it, because if we don't, the next generation will have a lot less, and the next generation will have a lot less.
Dunn also says that she sees any further investment in the oil industry as kind of crazy.
It's going to be obsolete, and it should be. I think we all need to get on the alternative energy wagon, and just whatever plan that we make, even in our small daily activities, we have to start remembering the seven generations, those that are coming, are going to need these resources too. And maybe they won't need oil, but they're certainly going to need water.
Some of those serving as water protectors at Standing Rock are veterans. But after honorably serving their country overseas, many veterans are upset with the treatment of their people here in the United States. Take Sky, a Marine veteran from Fairbanks, Alaska, and part of the Koyukon Athabascan tribe.
I went on a mission in Iraq, and they had sent me to go get drinking water.
They were doing road repairs, and they had run out of water. So Sky and one other person were sent down a road riddled with IEDs.
So we were basically going down the road where, you know, it was a suicide mission. And our truck got hit by an IED, and it was a miracle that, like, there was no shrapnel. We still have our body parts, you know, and and we make it back. And it just goes to show, like, they used drinking water as an excuse that was more, that was important enough to put our lives on the line. And, you know, we did that for our country. Why isn't drinking water important in our own country? It's basically the livelihood of all the people in this area.
Hi, this is my granddaughter, Nikki Gunsekwe.
Hello.
Little otter woman.
Hello.
Hello, say howdy.
Hi.
I'm just talking to your grandma. I'm just asking her a few questions.
Yeah. She's not going to, she thinks somebody wants to steal me all the time.
Oh, no. She's all yours.
Yep.
She doesn't believe you. I guess you look like a grandma thief.
I guess I do.
A granny nabber.
According to Dunn, Dakota Access has made it clear that they are not willing to back down, that they will go through with the pipeline regardless of the growing resistance to the project. Despite this, and despite the clashes with law enforcement, the people peacefully assembled at Standing Rock, both Native and non-Native alike, won't go down without a fight.
They tried to intimidate the people. These people are not intimidated, but they are going to stand up to this. They say this is the last stand. It's going to stop here. The last stand. Of course, I can't. I don't know the outcome. I know what I'd like for the outcome to be. Of course, I have no idea what's going to happen.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Emily LePain in Standing Rock, North Dakota.
Okay, we're back here with Emily LePain as she says goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye to Emily. And actually, that is the end of our show, Emily. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
How do you feel? It's all coming to a close.
I feel pretty odd.
I imagine.
It's been a fun time. I've learned things. I've met people. It's been good. I don't really know what to say. I'm bad at this
stuff. That's fine.
I'm bad at...
Did you enjoy your time with the
show? I did. You know, I did. It was stressful at times. And I think I had to come in on a Sunday once to do a story. And
oh,
I was like,
gosh,
deathly ill. But, you know, it's all worked out. I've learned a lot. I've had a lot of good experience. I'm not 100% sure where I'll be going after this. Whether or not I end up in media or radio or... I have no idea. So... I guess we'll see.
We'll see.
We'll see where the wind takes me, so to speak.
Right, of course. Well, it has been very nice working with you. I will say that. And we became pals, especially over the summer. It was just kind of like you and me.
It was.
Doing a lot of stuff for the show. So
yes, it was.
I will always remember that. And yeah, I enjoyed working with you.
Yeah.
So
the
that's
feeling
all.
Is mutual.
Well, that's so sweet. All right. Well, that's all. Unless you have anything else?
I definitely don't.
Okay.
Okay, then. I'm good.
And that'll do it.
Okay, that's it for this week's Real College Podcast. Now that Emily's gone, I just wanted to reiterate how much I really enjoyed working with her and how happy I am that she joined the team and she really... Like I said at the end there, like she really helped us get through the summer to kind of get to a point where, to the point where we're at now. So proud of her work, proud of who she is, and I guess that's all for Real College Podcast this week. My name is Patrick Shirky. I'm the managing editor here. Also, the show is produced by Jacob Maldonado Medina, Max Fuller, Emily Allen, and for the very last time, Emily LePain. Thanks so much for listening, and we will be back next week.